I'm correct. Well. Exhausted by all the effort, Harrow closed the journal and tucked it back inside her robe. She sank back down into the dusty embrace of the bones, wrist joints clacking as they lowered her onto the dark, slippery material of the duvet. She groped blindly for the water and spilled half of the remnants down her front as she took gulping, greedy sips. She dropped the empty glass onto the bed next to her, and then she closed her eyes. Gideon found herself gripping the slender rapier at her hip and feeling the heft of its basket hilt. "You could have died today," she said conversationally. For a long time, the girl on the bed was supine and silent. Her chest rose and fell slightly, evenly, as though in sleep. Then Harrow said, without opening her eyes, "You could attempt to finish me right now if you liked. You might even win." "Shut up," said Gideon, flat and grim. "I mean that you're making me look like a disloyal buffoon. I mean it's your fault that I can't take being your bodyguard seriously. I mean that all this sacred duty, do exactly as I say, blah 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 shit, does not matter in the least if you die of dehydration in a bone." "I wasn't about to—" "Baseline standard of a cavalier," said Gideon, "is you not dying in a bone. There was no—" "No. It's Gideon Nav talking time. I want to get out of here, and you want to be a lictor," she said. "We need to get information if that's going to happen. If you don't want me to ditch the paint, this sword, and the cover story, you're taking me down there with you." "Griddle, Gideon Nav talking time. The sixth must think we're absolutely full of horseshit. I'm going down there with you because I am sick of doing nothing. If I have to wander around faking a vow of silence and scowling for one more day, I will just open all my veins on top of teacher. Don't go down there solo. Don't die in a bone. I am your creature, Gloom Mistress. I serve you with fidelity as big as a mountain, penumbral lady." Harrow's eyes flickered open. "Stop. I am your sworn sword, Night Boss." "Fine," said Harrow heavily. Gideon's mouth was about to round out the words, "Bone Empress," before she realized what had been said. The expression on the other girl's face was now all resignation. Resignation and exhaustion, and also something else, but mostly resignation. "I acknowledge your argument," she said. "I disagree with it, but I see the margin of error. Fine." It would have been pushing her luck to point out that there was no real way Harrowhark could have denied her. She had the key, the upper hand, and significantly more blood. So all she said was, "Okay, great, fine. And you had better stop it with all this Twilight Princess garbage," said Harrow, "because I may start to enjoy it. Helping me will be achingly dull, Nav. I need patience. I need obedience. I need to know that you are going to act as though giving me devotion is your new favourite pastime, even though it galls us both senseless." Gideon, dizzy with success, crossed one leg around the other and leant back on the dresser in a posture of triumph. "Come on, how bad could it be?" Hera's lips curled. They showed her teeth stained slightly pink with blood. She smiled again, slower than before, just as terrible, just as strange. "Down there resides the sum of all necromantic transgression," she said, in the sing-song way of a child repeating a poem. "The unperceivable howl of 10,000 million unfed ghosts who will hear each echoed footstep as defilement. They would not even be satisfied if they tore you apart. The space beyond that door is profoundly haunted in ways I cannot say, and by means you won't understand, and you may die by violence, or you may simply lose your soul." Gideon rolled her eyes so hard that she felt in danger of twisting the optic nerve. "Knock it off, we're not in chapel now." But Hera said, "It's not one of mine, Griddle. I'm repeating exactly, to the word, what teacher said to me. Teacher said that the facility was chocker with ghosts and you might die.
Correct.
Surprise my tenebrous overlord, said Gideon. Ghosts and you might die is my middle name.
Chapter 14. This lapse of Herohark's did not make her one bit nicer to live with. Very early next morning, despite all logic and sense, she forced Gideon to put on the robe and paint on the paint like every morning since they'd arrived at Canaan House. She was impatient with what Gideon saw as the necessities of life, i.e. eating breakfast and stealing lunch. Gideon won the breakfast argument, but lost the right not to stare wretchedly at the mirror as she stippled black paint over her cheekbones. At Harrow's behest, the ninth house moved through the silent grey corridors like spies. There were many times when the necromancer would stop in the shadow of a doorway and wait there for fully 5 minutes before she would allow them both to carry on, to creep noiselessly down the shabby staircases and down to the bowels of the first. They only met one person on the way. In the light before sunrise, Harrow and Gideon pressed themselves up into the shadow of an archway and watched a figure with a book clenched in one hand cross a dusty hall, silent and shadowed, littered with sagging chairs. Because she had spent her whole life in the darkest hole of the darkest planet in the darkest part of the system, Gideon could make out the etiolated profile of the repellent third twin, Ianthe. She disappeared out of sight, and Hero remained, silently waiting, far longer than Gideon thought necessary before she gestured for them to move. They made it to the dismal hole with the access hatch without incident, though it was dark enough there that Gideon had to pocket her glasses and Harrow had to tug down her veil. Harrow was breathing impatiently through her nose as Gideon slid the key into the lock and flung herself down the hole as though being chased. They descended the long, frigid ladder, and Harrow brushed herself off at the bottom.
"Good," was the first thing she said since they'd left the room. "I'm relatively sure we're alone. Follow me."
Dogging her adept's rapid steps, rapier bumping against her hip, Gideon was interested to see that they did not traverse the maze-like corridors to sanitizer. They instead passed down a long, broad hallway, buzzing quietly with the sound of electric light, until, after a few corners, they reached a door marked Laboratory 2. Harrow pushed this open. The little foyer beyond was cupboard-sized. There were hooks on the walls, and on one what Gideon took to be some ugly, partly dissolved tapestry, until she realized it was the remains of somebody's abandoned coat. On the door ahead was a dilapidated folder behind a piece of plex, with a scribbled and pale title in a faded, haphazard hand, number 1-2, Transference Winnowing, Data Center. Above the sterile metal door was the more familiar sight of a mounted skull, probably once painted red but now tarry brown. It had lost its jaw at some point and seemed all front teeth. Harrow fussily crammed minuscule chips of phalange in and around the entryway. It was an unusual experience to be crossing, rather than barred from, a nonagesimus bone ward, but Gideon didn't get the time to enjoy it. Harrow pushed through the door and led Gideon through to another room. This room, more spacious, more elongated, gave the distinct impression of having been ransacked. It was ringed with broad metal desks, and the walls were pockmarked with empty electrical sockets. There were shelves and shelves that must once have contained books and files and folders, but now only contained a lot of dust. There were discoloured places on the walls where things must have been tacked up and had since been taken down. It was a naked and empty room. One wall was windowed all along its length, to let you see into the chamber ahead, and that wall had a door in it marked with two things. One, a sign on the front saying response, and two,
a little plaque on the top marked Occupied. This had a bleary glow of green light next to it, indicating that Response was probably not occupied. Looking through to Response, a bleak, featureless chamber, characterized only by a couple of vents on the far side of the square, the floor was an absolute shitshow of bits of broken bone. The other wall, filled with brackets to prop up books that had long since been removed, had a door too, and this one was labelled Imaging. The imaging door had the same plaque as Response, but with a little red light instead. Imaging also had a little plex window whose outside was smeared with old bloody handprints. "Someone's been having fun in here," said Gideon. Harrow shot her a look but did not enforce the vow of silence. "Yes," she said, "me." Her cavalier tried the door marked Response, but it wouldn't move, and there didn't seem to be a conventional touchpad. Harrow said, "It won't open like that, Nav. Come with me, and don't touch anything." Gideon went with Harrow and did not touch anything. The outdoor to imaging obligingly opened at their approach, revealing a dismal cupboard of a room with a huge array of old mechanical equipment, lightless and dead. A single ceiling panel fuzzed its way to life, white and pallid, and not revealing much but more shadow. The long desk still had what she realized was a rusted old clipboard, to which a thin, nearly transparent piece of paper was attached. Gideon at last gave in to the urge to touch something, and the paper dissolved as though it were ash. It left a grey stain on her fingertips. "Fucking yuck," she said, wiping them on her front. Harrow said curtly, "Have some care, you dolt. Everything here is impossibly old." In the centre of the room was a tall metal pedestal. Atop the pedestal was a strange flat panel of weirdly reflective glass, beautiful with a dichromatic black fleck. The black-robed necromancer, painted brow furrowed with concentration, passed her hand over the top of the glass. It buzzed at her proximity, sending shivering green sparks jumping over the pedestal. Harrow peeled off her glove and placed one long-fingered hand directly on the glass. Two things happened. The glass folded over her hand like a cage, and the imaging door shut with a heavy whonk. Gideon pressed into it, but it did not open again. "What happens now?" Harrow said. "Look through the window." Through the smeary little window, Gideon could see that Response had opened up. Harrow continued joylessly, "The door shuts in response to, as far as I can tell, weight and motion. I didn't test precisely how much weight, but it's around 30 moving kilograms. I have, at this point, sent around 90 kilos worth of bone matter into that room." The things Harrow could pull off with the tip of someone's toe bone were astonishing. 3 kilos of osseo for Harrow could have been anything. 1,000 skeletons crammed and interlocked within Response. Seas of spines, an edifice of cranium and coccyx. Gideon just said, "Why?" Harrow said stiffly. "Every single construct I've put into that room has been pulverized." "By what?" "I don't know," she said. "If I take my hand off the pedestal, the door unlocks and the room reverts. I can't see it, I only hear it." At "hear it," the hairs on the back of Gideon's neck rose, and she shook off her hood. Harrow jerked her wrist away from the pedestal, and the glass neatly unfolded itself from her hand. The imaging door opened with another automatic whonk, spilling light in from the anterior room. Harrow worked each finger gently within its socket and said, this time more brightly, "So, Griddle, this is where you are to be my shining star. You're going out there to be my eyes." "What?" "My skeletons don't have photoreceptors, Nav," the necromancer said calmly. "I know they're being destroyed with blunt force. I have no idea what by, and I need to keep my hand on the thanagetic lock. You have perfectly functional eye jelly.
You have a dubious but capable brain. You're going to stand out there and look through the window. Got it?
There was nothing objectionable to this role, which was why Gideon was automatically suspicious of it. But she said, "As you wish, my lamentable queen," and ducked out the imaging door. Her adept followed close behind her, rummaging in her pockets. She brought out a whole knuckle, which was telling. Harrow threw it down, and with an awful grinding sound, it sprang into a burly skeleton. She flicked her wrist at it impatiently, and it lumbered toward response, standing, waiting. Then Harrow ducked back inside imaging.
"This is dumb," thought Gideon.
The imaging door wheezed shut, presumably as Harrow placed her hand upon the pedestal, and the response door ground open. The skeleton stepped forward, bone feet crunching on a carpet of other bones. As it stepped through, the door plunged shut behind it, and the little light next to occupied turned red. Whatever happened next happened pretty goddamn fast. The lights in response flared as the vents started choking out cloudy puffs, obscuring the far wall. She pressed herself so close to the glass that her breath made it misty and wet. There was no sound from within, and there should have been. It must have all been soundproofed, which simply made it all the more absurd when something enormous and misshapen came raging out of the fog. It was a bone construct, she could tell that much. Grey tendons strapped a dozen weirdly malformed humeri to horribly abbreviated forearms. The ribcage was banded straps of thick, knobbly bone, spurred all around with sharp points. The skull, was it a skull? A huge knobble of brain pan. Two great green lights foamed within the darkness there, like eyes. It had way too many legs and a spine like a load-bearing pillar, and it had to crouch forward on two of its heavy-set arms, fledged all over with tibial spines. The exterior arms were thrust back high, and she could see now that they did not have hands, just long, slender blades, each formed from a sharpened radius, held at the ready like a scorpion's tail. It rampaged forward. Her skeleton patiently waited. The construct fell on it like a hot meal, and it disintegrated under the second blow. The construct turned its awful head toward the window, fixed its burning green gaze on Gideon, and got very still. It lumbered toward her, gaining speed, when the red light for occupied turned green. There was a low and doleful harp from some klaxon, and then the construct dissolved. It became soup, not bones, and it moved as though sucked into some small grating toward the center of the room. It was totally gone, along with all the fog, when imaging sprang open and Hera found her cavalier with her jaw dropped open. It took a few moments of explanation. Hera cross-questioned the measurements and looked disgusted with all her answers. Before Gideon had finished, Harrow was pacing back and forth, robes swishing around her ankles like black foam.
"Why can't I see it?" she raged. "Is it testing the skeleton's autonomy, or is it testing my control? How much multidexterity does it want?"
"Put me in there," said Gideon. That brought Harrow up short, and her eyebrows shot to the top of her hairline. She fretted at the veil around her neck, and she said slowly,
"Why?"
Gideon knew at this point that some really intelligent answer was the way to go, something that would have impressed the reverend daughter with her mechanical insight and cunning, a necromantic answer with some shadowy, magical interpretation of what she had just seen. But her brain had only seen the one thing, and her palms were damp with the sweat that came when you were both scared and dying of anticipation. So she said, "The arms kind of looked like swords. I want to fight it."
"You want to fight it?"
"Yep."
"Because it looked a little like swords?"
"Yep."
Harrow massaged her temples with one hand and said, I'm not yet so desperate for a new cavalier that I'm willing to recycle you. No, I'll send in 3 this time, and you're to tell me how it handles that, exactly how it responds. I'm not yet convinced that this isn't testing my multidexterity.
The next time she sent a skeleton in, it was clutching a crinkly bundle of phalanges in each bony fist. Gideon watched dutifully as the light turned green, and as Harrow sightlessly raised 2 identical skeletons next to her first. They were models of their kind, beautifully made, built to spec, animated and responsive. Harrow's skeletons looked almost like first house servants now. When the construct flailed out of the mist, they moved with admirable poise and fluency, and got demolished in 3 moves. The last skeleton ran around in a sad little sprint before the monstrous construct raised 1 bladed arm and shattered it from sacrum to shoulder. The second time Hera emerged to get the blow-by-blow, 1 nostril was bleeding. The 3rd time, both nostrils. The 5th time, the floor of response carpeted with the remains of 20 skeletons. She was wiping blood off her eyelashes and her shoulders were drooping. She had listened to each playback with numb, blank-eyed thoughtfulness, too distracted even to needle Gideon. But this time, she balled her hands into fists and pressed them into her skull. "My mother and my father and my grandmother together could not do what I do," she said softly, not speaking to Gideon. "My mother and my father and my grandmother together. And I'd advanced so far beyond them. 1 construct or 50, and it simply slows it down for all of 30 minutes. She shook away frustration like an animal with a wet pelt, shivering all over before fixing dead black eyes on Gideon.
"Right," she said. "Right. Again. Keep watching, Nav."
She staggered back, door whipping shut behind her. Gideon Nav could only put up with so much. She took off her robe, folded it up, and put it on a hook in the foyer. She stood next to a skeleton whose arms were so full with bits of bone and lengths of tibia that it trailed chips like breadcrumbs. It was easy enough to stand beside it politely until the door opened, then to trip it up, then to step over it. She unsheathed her rapier with a silver whisper, slipping the knuckles of her left hand through the obsidian bands. The response door breathed shut behind her.
"Harrow," she said, "if you wanted a cavalier you could replace with skeletons, you should have kept Ortus."
From whining speakers set in each corner, Harrow cried out. It wasn't a noise of annoyance, or even really a noise of surprise. It was more like pain. Gideon found her legs buckling a little bit, and she had to stagger, shift herself upright, shake her head to clear the brief bout of dizziness away. She held her rapier in a perfect line and waited.
"What?"
The necromancer sounded dazed almost.
"What? Seriously?"
The vents breathed out huge sighs of fog. Now that she was in the room, Gideon could see that they were blasting moisture and liquid into the air, stale-smelling stuff. From within this cloud, the construct was rising, leg to horrifying leg, to broad plates of pelvis, to thick trunk of spine, to the green motes of light that swung around, searching, settling on Gideon. Her stance shifted. From imaging, Hera grunted explosively, which nearly got her cavalier knocked ass over tits. Air was displaced. The construct rushed her, and it was only just in time that she deflected 2 heavy overhand blows onto the naked black blade of her sword. Harrow let out a yelp as though she had touched her hand to a flame.
"Nona Jazimus!"
Gideon considered the good news and the bad news. The good news, the blows that rained down on her were not as heavy as she had expected from something so enormous. They came down hard and fast, but no harder than the hand of Nibirius Turn, lighter for the lack of muscle.
Osseous matter never weighed as much as blood and flesh, which was one of the problems with pure construct magic. The bad news. She couldn't do jack shit to it. Her light sword could barely deflect the blows. She had some small hope with her obsidian knuckle knives. One good strong backhand bash and she had knocked out part of one arm, snapping the blade off near the tip. But then watched with a sickening weight in her gut as the blade reformed. Nona Jesimus! She hollered again between attacks. This shit is regenerating! There was nothing from the speakers. Gideon wondered if Harrow could hear her. She leapt to the side as the construct fell forward, slashing heavily. It slammed into a pile of bone that had built up from Harrow's previous failures, and a chip careered out like a bullet and nicked Gideon's arm. From the speakers, the girl cried out again. Nona Jesimus! She said, alarmed now. The construct wallowed in its nest of victims, then reared up again. Hey! Harrow! The speakers crackled. Stop thinking! What? I can't! It's too... Damn it! She was about to tell Harrow to take her hand off the damn pedestal, but she was charged again in a lurching flurry of blades. The construct bounded forward on its hands and feet like a lopsided predatory animal. Gideon charged too, and she sliced her sword straight through the interosseous membrane on the arm coming down to spear her. Arm and construct flailed independently, and with her offhand, she punched it hard in the pelvis. Bones splintered out explosively as half the ilium came away. The monster fell and thrashed, trying to rise, as the pelvis and the top of one femur knit themselves back together with unsavory speed. Gideon fell back in a hurry, pulling her sword free and wiping bone matter off her face. The speakers sizzled with heavy breathing. Nav, close one eye! She would question later why she did it. But she did it. Depth perception fled as she squinted an eye shut, backing away from the construct as it slithered around in useless circles, crippled. For a moment, her gaze drunkenly slid into place, and she could see something at the very corners of her vision, some kind of peripheral mirage, a susurrus of light that moved in a way she'd never seen before. It was like a gel overlay across real life. It balled around various bits of the construct as though attracted to it, like iron filings to a magnet. She blinked hard. There was fresh panting over the speakers. All right, came Harrow's voice. All right, all right. The construct reared up, center of gravity restored. Gideon's heart hammered. The speakers hissed again. Harrow said, What's on top of it? What, the arms? I can't see, said Harrow. Blurry. Gideon had to open both eyes again. She couldn't not. She parried the first uppercut thrust from the construct as it bounded toward her, but it cracked her in the shoulder with another. She got it with her knives on the backswing. The sharpened arm cracked, bounced away and hit the wall, but she had to fall back into a crouch and seethe with pain, worrying that her shoulder had popped out entirely. The speakers bellowed. The construct reared up, other blades at the ready, and disassembled. It turned to liquid and trickled toward the grate in the center of the room as Gideon stared. The response door slid open, and after a moment's testing of her shoulder, she pulled herself to stand. She was working the muscles as she went through the doorway. It locked shut. Imaging opened, and she found herself face to face with Harrow, who was taut as death and trembling. The hell, said Gideon, was that? It's the test. Harrow's lips were pink where she had bitten off the paint. She seemed to be having trouble swallowing, and she was staring right through her cavalier. She said unsteadily, You're the test. Frontal, parietal, temporal, occipital, hippocampus. I fought with them all inside you, she said. I'm not equipped to deal with a living spirit still attached to a nervous system. You're so noisy, It took me 5 minutes to peel away the volume just to see. And the pain is so much worse than skeleton feedback. Your spirit rendered me deaf. Your whole body makes noise when you fight. Your temporal lobe. God, I have such a headache. This entire speech was incoherent, but the bottom line realization was humiliating. Heat rose rapidly up Gideon's neck. You can control my body, she said. You can read my thoughts. No, not remotely. That was a relief, until it was followed up with, if only I could. The moment I get a handle on even one of your senses, I'm overwhelmed by another. You are banned from squatting in my lobes and my hippocampus. I don't want you pushing all the furniture around in there. Perhaps there was some tiny grain of sympathy in Harrow. She did not respond with a horrid laugh or a dark ninth saying. She just flapped her hand. Don't have an aneurysm, Nav. I cannot and will not read your thoughts, control your body, or look at your most intimate memories. I don't have the ability, and I certainly don't have the desire. It's for your protection, not mine, said Gideon. I imagined Crux's butt once when I was 12. Harrow ignored her. Winnowing, she said. I'm a fool. It wants the wheat from among the chaff, or the signal from the noise, if you like. But why? Why can't I just do it myself? She swayed lightly and swabbed a pink line across her face with one sleeve. Her cultist paint was looking distinctly sepia, but she looked elated, grimly satisfied somehow. I now know how to complete this trial, she said meditatively, and will do it if I work out the connection and rethink what I know about possession theory. I can do it. Knowing what to work on was the battle, and now I know. But first, Griddle, I'm afraid I have to pass out. And she crumpled neatly back onto the floor. Pure sentiment found Gideon kicking out one leg to catch her. She ended up lightly punting her necromancer on the shoulder, but assumed that it was the thought that counted. Chapter 15. I'd do a hell of a lot better with a longsword, Gideon said. A few hours after, Herohark had woken up from her floor nap and accompanied her cavalier back to their quarters. She'd been all for trying again then and there, but it took Gideon one look at her slightly crossing eyes and shaky hands to nix that plan. Now they were back in their main, dark-panelled room, the noonday light filtering through the blinds in hot slats of white, with Gideon galumphing down bread and Harrow picking at crusts. The necromancer had woken up just as sour as ever, which gave Gideon some hope that everything back there had been a passing fit of insanity. "Insinuation denied," said Herohark. "You don't have one." "Sweet." That meant Harrow hadn't successfully been through all her stuff. And more importantly, you should do without. I never liked that cursed thing anyway. I always felt like it was judging me. If you require a two-handed sword every time the chips are down, you're worth nothing as my cavalier. I still don't get how this whole test is meant to work. The Reverend's daughter gave this consideration for once. All right, let me... You know that a bone construct is animated by a necromantic theorem? No way! I assumed you just thought super hard about bones until they happened. Ignoring this, Hera continued. This particular construct is animated by multiple theorems, all woven together in a sense. That enables it to do things normal constructs can't possibly. Like regenerate. Yes. The way to destroy it is to unpick that tapestry, Nav, to pull on each thread in turn, in order, until the web gives way, which would take me 10 seconds if I only had it at arm's length. Huh, said Gideon, unwillingly starting to get it. So I unpick it for you? Only with my assistance. You are not a necromancer. You cannot see thanagetic signatures. I have to find the weak points, but I have to do it through your eyes, which is made infinitely more difficult by you waving a sword around the whole time while your brain yells at me. Gideon opened her mouth to say, "My brain is always yelling at you," but was interrupted by a sharp rap on the door. The necromancer froze, as though she were under attack, but this knock was followed by guttural hysterics of the kind that Gideon had heard before. The sound drifted off down the corridor, accompanied by the hurried footsteps of two semi-terrified teenagers. Jean-Marie and What's-His-Face had shoved something underneath the door and left. She went to see what it was. It was a plain, heavy envelope, real paper, creamy brown. "Reverend Daughter Herohawk Nonagesimus," she read out loud, "Gideon the Ninth. Fan mail." "Give it to me. It might be a trap." Gideon ignored this, as it was quite likely Hera would toss the thing out the window rather than give it a chance. She also ignored Hera's lemon-pucker scowl as she withdrew a piece of flimsy, less impressive than the envelope, but who, barring the Emperor, would use real paper for a letter, and read aloud its contents. "Lady Abigail Pent and Sir Magnus Quinn, in celebration of their 11th wedding anniversary, present their compliments to the heir and cavalier primary of the 9th house, and request the honour of their company this evening. Dinner to be served at 7 o'clock. Underneath, in hasty but still beautifully formed handwriting, was another note. "Don't be affrighted by the wording. Abigail can't resist a formal invitation. At home, I'm practically issued one for breakfast. Not at all a serious function, and would be deeply pleased if you could both see fit to come. I will make dessert. Can reassure you, I cook better than I duel. M." Harris said, "No." "I want to go," said Gideon. "This sounds impossibly vapid. I want to eat a dessert." "It occurs to me," said Hera, drumming her fingers, "that during a single dinner, the deaths of multiple house signs could be assured by one clever pair, a bottle of poison, and then, suddenly, the 5th house primacy is assured, and all because you wanted a suite. This is a formal invitation to the 9th house, not just you and me," said Gideon more cunningly. "And being dyed-in-the-wool traditionalists, shouldn't we make a teeny-weeny appearance? It'll look rude if we don't go. We can extrapolate heaps from whoever doesn't come, and everyone will, to be polite. Politics, diplomacy. I'll eat yours if you don't want it." The necromancer lapsed into brooding. "But this delays finishing the trial," she complained finally, "and wastes an evening in which Sextus can get ahead of us at his leisure. Bet you Palamedes will be there. We can do the trial afterward, and I'll be so good. I'll be silent and ninth and melancholy. The sight will astound and stimulate you. Nev, you are a hog." But that meant they were going to go. Gideon reflected on her unexpected victory as she stared in the mirror, idly counting the pimples cropping up as the result of repeated slathers of cult paint. The atmosphere was relaxed in this strange and waiting way, like the time she'd got a sedative and knew a nun was coming to whip out her tonsils. She and Nonagesimus were both waiting for the knife. She had never known Harrow to be so malleable, nor to go such a long time without raking her claws across Gideon's internal tender spots. Maybe the lictor trials were having a mellowing effect on her. No, that was too much to hope for. Herohark was pleased because everything was coming up Herohark. She was glutted on getting her own way, and the moment that glow wore off, the knives would come out again. Gideon couldn't trust Harrow. There was always some angle, there was always some shackle closing on you before you could even see it, and you'd only know when she turned the key. But then, that evening, it was funny to see Harrow fuss. She put on her best and most senescent 9th robes and became a skinny black stick swallowed by night-coloured layers of locked tomb lace. She fiddled with long earrings of bone in front of the mirror and repainted her face twice. Gideon realized, with no small amount of amusement and curiosity, that Harrowhawk was very frightened. She got more snappish as the evening wore on, and moved from languid postures of affected boredom with a book to a tense, rolled-up curl with hunched shoulders and knees. Harrow kept staring at the clock and wanted to go a full 20 minutes early. Gideon had just thrown on a clean robe and her tinted glasses, and noted that the necromancer was too tetchy even to veto those. Why on earth was she scared? She had headed up function after dreary, over-embroidered ninth function, ornate in its rules and strict in its regulations since she was a kid. Now she was all jitters. Maybe it was about being denied her dark necromantic needs down past the access hatch. In any case, both she and Harrowhark turned up gorgeously gowned in their locked tomb vestments, painted like living skulls, looking like douchebags. Harrow clinked when she walked with the sheer multiplicity of bonely accoutrement. "You came," said Magnus Quinn when he saw them. He was too well-bred to double-take at two horrible examples of Dreaber clergy on the loose. "I'm so pleased you're wearing your, glad rags. I was convinced I'd be the only one dressed up and would have to sit resplendently among you all, feeling a bit of an idiot." "Reverend daughter," he said, and he bowed very deeply to Harrow, "thank you for coming." He himself was immensely trim in a pale brown long-coated suit that had probably cost more than the ninth house had in its coffers. The ninth was high on ancient shitty treasures, but low on liquid assets. In a lower and chillier voice than Harrow usually ever affected, she said, "Blessings on the Cavalier of the Fifth. Congratulations on the 11th year of your espousal." Espousal. But Magnus said, "Indeed, yes, thank you. It was actually yesterday, by happy accident. I remembered and Abigail forgot, so in her resulting angst she wanted to make me dinner. I suggested we all benefit. Come in, please. Let me introduce you." The dining room off the atrium looked as it ever did, but with certain festive additions. The napkins had all been folded very carefully, and some mildly yellowing tablecloth had come out of deep storage. There were correctly articulated place cards by each bright white plate. They were both led to the little kitchen and introduced to the slightly stressed fifth necromancer, whom Gideon had only ever seen in passing. She proved to have more or less the same easy, unaffected manner as Magnus, the type you only got when you came from a house like the fifth. She looked Gideon very straight in the eye and shook her hand very firmly. Unlike Magnus, she also had the manner some necromancers and librarians developed when they had been working on dead spells for the last 15 years and no longer worried too much about the living. Her stare was far too intense. But she was wearing an apron, and it was hard to feel intimidated by her. Her very correct pleasantries, with a po-faced Harrow, were interrupted with the appearance in the doorway of the wretched teens, who were wearing around 1 million earrings each. The ninth moved back to the hall. It was a strange evening. Harrow nearly vibrated with tension. Teacher, perennially pleased to see them for no reason Gideon ever knew, cornered them immediately. He and the other priests were there already, and each had a birthday expression of glee. For his part, Teacher was twinkling with a magnitude usually reserved for dying stars.
"What do you think of Lady Abigail?" he said. "They do say she's an extraordinarily clever necromancer. Not so much in your line, Reverend Daughter, but a gifted summoner and spirit talker. I have fielded many questions from her about Canaan House. I hope she and Magnus the Fifth are good cooks. We first have all hyped the occasion, I'm afraid, But priests who live plainly must get excited over food. Of course, the Somber Ninth must be similar.
The Somber Ninth, in the form of its adept, said,
"We prefer to live simply."
Of course," said teacher, whose attention had already wandered to trashy gossip.
His bright blue eyes had searched the room for other objects of interest, and finding them, leaned in confidingly.
"Yes, and there's young Jean-Marie the Fourth and Isaac Tetterus, looking very pretty, the both of them. Isaac looks as though he has been studying too much."
Isaac, the necromancer teen, with brushed-up hair, bleached orange, looked more like he was suffering an abundance of pituitary gland.
"Naturally, he is Pent's protégé. I hear the Fifth takes special pains with the Fourth. Hegemonic pains, some may say. It must be difficult when they are both so young, but they all seem to get on well."
"How do you know?"
"Reverend daughter," the priest said, smiling, "you miss out on important things spending all your time so usefully down in the dark. Now, Gideon the Ninth, she could tell you a great deal if she were not bound to her admirable vow of silence. Your penitence shames me."
At this, teacher gave Gideon a roguish wink, which was also the worst. Movement in the doorway. The third and sixth houses had arrived all at once, the drab moth of Palamedes making the golden butterfly of Coronabeth Tridentarius all the more aureate and fair. They were sizing each other up like prize-fighters. Teacher said,
"Now, the main event!"
It turned out that the Fifth's idea of a rollicking good time was a seating arrangement. This realization caused Hera's carefully controlled mask to take on a distinct veer to the tragic. They were separated, and Gideon found herself elbow to elbow between Palamedes and the dreadful teen Cavalier of the Fourth, who looked as though she regretted everything that had ever led up to this moment. Dulcinea, opposite, kissed her hand to Gideon twice before Gideon had even sat down. At least Hera wasn't faring any better. She had been placed at the other end of the table, diagonal to the mayonnaise uncle, who looked even more appalled than Jean-Marie the Fourth. Opposite was Ianthe, and to the other diagonal was Protesilaus, completing one of the worst tableaus in history. Nabirius Turn was to Hera's left and was carrying on some long communication with Ianthe, conducted entirely in arch eyebrow quirks. As Hera smouldered with hatred, Gideon began to enjoy herself. Magnus clinked his spoon against his water glass. The conversation, which was terminal to start with, convulsed to a halt.
"Before we begin," he said, "a short speech."
The three priests looked as though they had never wanted anything so much in their lives as a short speech. One of the teens, slumped out of Magnus's sight, mimed putting their neck in a noose.
"I thought I'd," he began, "say a few words to bring us all together. This must be the first time in a very long time that the houses have been together like this. We were reborn together, but remain so remote. So I thought I'd point out our similarities rather than our differences. What do Martyr the Second, Nabirius the Third, Jean-Marie the Fourth, Magnus the Fifth, Camilla the Sixth, Protesilaus the Seventh, Colum the Eighth, and Gideon the Ninth all have in common?"
You could have heard a hair flutter to the floor. Everyone stared, poker-faced, in the thick ensuing silence. Magnus looked pleased with himself.
"The same middle name," he said.
Coronabeth laughed so hard that she had to honk her beautiful nose into a napkin. Someone was explaining the joke to the salt and pepper priest, who, when they got it, said,
"Oh, duh!"
which started Corona off again.
The second, entombed in dress uniforms so starched you could fold them like paper, wore the tiny smiles of two people who'd had to put up with cohort formal dinners before. The appearance of two skeletons bearing an enormous tureen of food broke the last tension. Under Abigail's direction, they filled everyone's bowl with good-smelling grain, white and fluffy, boiled in onion broth. Little drifts of chopped nuts or tiny tart red fruits were scattered throughout, and it was hot and spicy and good, which had completed Gideon's requirements for a meal at hot. She put her head down and ate, insensible, until one of the white-robed skeletons stepped forward to give her seconds. At that point, she could tune in to the conversations around her, which had survived their first faltering encounters with the enemy and were now in full swing.
"The juicy part is the Sarcotesta. Good, aren't they? There's a red seed apple growing in the greenhouse. Have you seen the greenhouses?"
"In keeping with Atavian custom for a necromancer's fast until evening, which includes..." "Which failed to fix the drive, which failed to get her back to the system in time, which meant I spent the first 9 months wrapped in house dirt."
"Interesting question," Palladomes was saying at Gideon's right. "You might say the scholar recognizes the specialist, and Warden recognizes the duty, which is why Master Warden is the higher rank, taken in the sense of the supervisor, and, if you think about it another way, the sense of the prison. Do you know what we call the internal jaws of a lock?"
Opposite, Dulcinea murmured to Abigail.
"I think that is a perfect shame."
"Thank you. We're over it. It simply wasn't in our cards," the necromancer said a bit bracingly. "My younger brother's the next in line. He'll do well. It gives me more time to collate the manuscript, which I've been married to longer than I have to madness.
So keep in mind, I'm the kind of pity case you bring out at parties to make other people feel better about themselves," the other woman said smilingly, ignoring the fifth's polite protests to the contrary. "But I would love you to explain your work, just so long as you pretend I am five and go from there."
"If I can't explain this clearly, then the fault is mine, not yours. It's not so complex. We have so little that survived from the period post-resurrection, pre-sovereignty and pre-cohort, except in second-hand records. We have transcripts of those from the sixth, though they're keeping the originals."
"They're kept in a box full of helium, so they'll outlast the heat death of Dominicus, Lady Pent," said Palamedes.
"Your masters won't even let me look at them through the glass."
"Light is the paper killer," he said.
"Sorry,
it's nothing against you. It's not in our particular interest to hoard literal records."
"They're good copies, at least, and I spend my time studying those, writing commentary, naturally. But being here meant almost more to me than the idea of serving the Emperor. Kenan House is a holy grail. What we know about the lictors is tremendously antiseptic. I've actually found what I think are unencrypted communiques between..."
Even with Dulcinea Septimus making the intense eyelash bat of,
"What you are doing and saying is so fascinating to me, Dulcinea Septimus,"
Gideon knew a boring conversation when she heard one. She took cautious sips of the purple, slightly chewy wine, and was trying not to cough as she swung her attention over to her own shadowy marchioness of bones. Harrow was picking at the food, sandwiched between the stony cavaliers of the seventh and second. Every so often, she would say something terse to Protesilaus, who would take 60 seconds to think about it before making replies so uninflected and curt that they made Harrow sparkle by comparison. The mayonnaise uncle was talking to the anemic twin, his probable future bride.
"I was removed by surgical means," Ianthe was saying calmly, her long fingers toying with the stem of her glass. "My sister is a few minutes older."
The white-kirtled young uncle was not eating. He had taken a few priggish sips of wine, but spent most of his time with his hands folded quietly over each other and staring.
He had the posture of a meter ruler.
"Your parents,"
he said, in his unexpectedly deep and sonorous voice.
"Risked intervention."
"Yes. Corona, you see, had removed my source of oxygen."
"A wasted opportunity, I'd think."
"I don't live alternate histories. Corona's birth put my survivability somewhere around definite nil."
"It wasn't on purpose, mark you,"
drawled her cavalier from across the table. His hair was so perfect that Gideon kept staring at it, mesmerized, hoping some specific bit of the ceiling would break down and squash it flat. Ianthe affected shock. "Why, Babs, are you part of this conversation?"
"I'm just saying, Princess, you don't have to be so down on her like that."
"You don't have to contradict me in public, and yet... Nabirius flicked his eyes very obviously over to the other end of the table, but Coronabeth was busy with Magnus, probably swapping new jokes, Gideon thought. He said,
"Stop being a pill."
"I repeat, Babs, are you part of this conversation?"
"Thank God, no," said the hapless Babs sourly, and turned back to his previous conversation partner, the thick-set nephew cavalier, stolidly refilling his bowl.
He did not look thrilled to repossess the third's undivided attention. Next to the spruce Nabirius Tern, he looked shabbier and more worn out than ever.
"Now look, Aeth, here's why you're wrong about the buckler."
Gideon would have liked to know what was wrong about the buckler, but as she reached over for her glass again, she felt a tug on her sleeve. It was the disagreeable teen who was sitting on her other side, looking at her with a particularly fierce expression, emphasized with near ninth quantities of black eye makeup. Jean-Marie the Fourth screwed up her mouth as though expecting an injection, all the little corners of her face more angular in ferociousness, her Gillian earrings jingling.
"This is going to be a weird question," said Jean-Marie.
Gideon dropped her arm and tilted her head quizzically. A little bit of blood drained from the teen's face, and Gideon almost felt sorry for her. Hood and paint and robes on the priesthood around her had put her off dinners at the same age, but the teen stuck her awful courage to its sticking place, breathed out hard through her teeth, and blurted very quickly,
"Ninth, how big are your biceps?"
It seemed to be long after Gideon was forced to supinate and flex at the whim of a teenage girl that their bowls were replaced with new ones, these filled with confections of cream and fruit, and mostly sugar. The fifth had obviously been busy. Gideon ate three helpings, and Magnus, not bothering to hide his amusement, pushed a fourth her way. Magnus was inarguably a much better cook than a duelist. Before she had come to Canaan House, Gideon had considered getting full a grim process of gruel and spoon and mouth that had to be done in order to maximize chances of not having her ass later kicked by Aiglemine in some dim room. It was one of the first times that she had felt full and fat and honestly happy about it. Afterward, there was a tray of the hot, grassy tea to clear the mouth, and the various houses stood around with warm cups in their hands to watch the skeletons clear up. Gideon looked around for Harrow. Her necromancer was ensconced in a corner with, of all people, Teacher. She was talking to him in low tones as he alternately nodded or shook his head, looking more thoughtful than giddy for once, his thumbs stuck in his gorgeous rainbow sash. Someone touched Gideon's hand, very lightly, as though afraid of startling her. It was Dulcinea, who had taken refuge in a chair. She was shifting her hips a little awkwardly in the hard wooden seat, with the tiny, restless motions Gideon suspected she made when she was sore. She looked tired and older than usual, but her pink mouth was still very pink, and her eyes alight with illicit amusement.
"Are your biceps huge?" she said. "Or are they just enormous? Ninth, please tick the correct box."
Gideon made sure her necromancer couldn't see her, and then made a rude gesture. Dulcinea laughed her silvery laugh, but it was sleepy somehow. Quiet. She pointed serenely to a spot next to her seat, and Gideon obligingly squatted there on her haunches. Dulcinea was breathing a little harder. She was wearing a filmy, foam-coloured dress, and Gideon could see her ribs expand beneath it like a shocked animal's. Her silky, chestnut-coloured ringlets, painstakingly curled, spread out over her shoulders.
"I liked that dinner," said Lady Septimus, with deep satisfaction. "It was useful. Look at the children."
Gideon looked. Isaac and Jean-Marie were standing close to the table, Jean-Marie's sleeves pulled down to reveal her biceps. They were the muscles of an athletic and determined 14-year-old, which was to say, unripped but full of potential. Her floppy-haired teen in crime was wearily measuring them with his hands as they carried on a conversation in whispers.
"I told you so.
Yours are fine."
"Isaac?"
"It's not like this is a bicep competition."
"Dumbest thing you ever said."
Their hisses carried. Abigail, who was standing nearby, deep in conversation with one of the second, reached out a hand to touch Isaac lightly on the shoulder in reproof. She did not even turn around or break off talking. The fourth adept winced. His cavalier had a hard, resentful, told-off expression on her face. Dulcinea murmured,
"Oh, Gideon the Ninth, the houses are arranged so badly, full of suspicion after a whole myriad of peaceable years. What do they compete for? The Emperor's favour? What does that look like? What can they want? It's not as though they haven't all gotten fat off our cohort prizes, mostly. I have been thinking about all that lately, and the only conclusion I can come to is..."
She trailed off. They were both silent in that pause's pregnant wake, listening to the polite and impolite after-dinner chatter all around them, the clatter of skeletons with used-up knives and forks. Into that white noise came Palamedes, who was, weirdly enough, bearing a full teacup on a tray. He proffered it to the weary lady of the Seventh, who looked at him with frank interest.
"Thank you awfully, Master Warden," she said.
If she had looked at him with interest, he looked at her with... Well. He looked at her thin and filmy dress, and her swell-jointed fingers, and at her curls and the crest of her jaw, until Gideon felt hell of embarrassed being anywhere near that expression. It was a very intense and focused curiosity. There wasn't a hint of smoulder in it, not really, but it was a look that peeled skin and looked through flesh. His eyes were like lustrous grey stone. Gideon didn't know if she could be as completely composed as Dulcinea under that same look. Palamedes said lightly,
"I'm ever at your service, Lady Septimus."
Then he gave a small trim bow like a waiter, adjusted his spectacles, and abruptly turned tail.
Well, thought Gideon, watching him slide back into the crowd. Hell!
Then she remembered that the Sixth had a weirdo fascination with medical science and probably found chronic illness as appealing as a pair of tight shorts. And then she thought,
well, hell!
Dulcinea was placidly sipping her tea. Gideon stared at her, waiting for the conclusion that had never come. Eventually, the Seventh tore her gaze away from the small crowd of house scions and their cavalier primaries, and she said,
"My conclusion? It's... Oh, there's your necromancer."
Harrow had broken off from teacher and was homing in on Gideon like iron to a lodestone. She offered Dulcinea only the most cursory glance. Dulcinea herself was smiling with what she obviously thought was infinite sweetness and what Gideon knew to be an expression of animal cunning. For Gideon, not even a word, but a thrust of the pointy chin upward. Gideon propelled herself to stand and tried to ignore the seventh's eyebrows waggling in their direction, which, thankfully, her necromancer didn't notice. Harrowhark was too busy storming out of the room with her robe billowing out behind her in the way Gideon suspected she had secretly practiced. She heard Magnus the Fifth call out a gentle, "I am glad you came, Ninth!" But Harrow took no time to say goodbye, which hurt her feelings a little, because Magnus was nice. "Slow down, numbnuts," she hissed, when she thought they were out of earshot of anyone. "Where's the fire?"
"Nowhere, yet."
Harrow sounded breathless. "I've eaten my own body weight. Don't make me hurl."
"As mentioned before, you're a hog. Hurry up. We don't have much time."
"What?" There was a moment's respite as Harrow hauled open one of the little escape route staircase doors. The sun had set, and the generator lights glowed a sad and disheartened green. The skeletons, busy with dinner, had apparently not lit the candles.
"What do you mean?" "I mean, we need to make up time."
"Hey, repeatedly, on what grounds?"
Harrow propped open the door with a bony hand. The expression on her face was resolute.
"Because Abigail Pent asked that faithless eighth prig if he knew about access down to the lower floors," she said, "and he said yes. Pent is not stupid, and that's another confirmed competitor on our hands. For God's sake, hurry up, Griddle. I give us 5 hours before she's in the chamber herself."
Chapter 16 Gideon Nav held her sword parallel to her body, the grease-black glass of her knuckle knives close to her chest, and bit her tongue bloody. As most bitten tongues did, it hurt like an absolute bitch. Over the speakers, Harrow heaved. In front of her, still wet with the hot reek of powdered bone, the construct opened its mouth in a soundless shriek. They were back in response, and they'd failed once already. It wasn't as though Harrow's necromantic inability to chisel her skull open was from some reluctance of Gideon's, which would have been completely fucking understandable. She was trying as hard as she could. She was sleepy from the food, and she was sore from earlier that morning, and being sleepy and sore meant there was so much more for Harrowhark to wade through. Gideon was forced to give her necromancer the first particle of credit in her life. Harrow did not yell at her. Harrow simply sank deeper and deeper into a morass of frustration and self-hatred, her fury at herself rising like bile.